you've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hello, hello, everyone. Tamara here from Inside Launch Street. Good to connect with you all again. Today, I have a guest for you. Now, as you know, I only bring on guests that I think are going to help you elevate your innovation advantage, elevate being an actual innovator, because as the title of my book says, innovation is everybody's business. We are all capable of it. So let me tell you about Chuck in a second. Before I get into that, I just want to share two things that are exciting and important that are going on here at Launch Street that I think you need to know about. Now, if you are on my mailing list or have connected with me in a different way, you might have heard this, but I want to make sure it really sinks in because it's so important. Our Everyday Innovators Tribe is up and going with gusto. We've got some incredible founding members. We're adding members all the time. I'm so excited. Let me tell you a little bit about it. I built the Everyday Innovators Tribe to help business leaders innovate and give you the tools, the community, and the resources to make that happen so that you can solve your biggest challenges, create breakthrough outcomes, and accelerate your success. It is so incredible what we've got going on there. These monthly innovation jam sessions online, these bursts of innovation that happen daily so that you're set up for success during the day, live Q&A sessions, the IQE, the assessment of how you innovate in the book, of course, so that you can learn all about you and your greatest competitive advantage. So if you haven't checked it out, go to our website, click on the tribe link, and give it a feel. See if it's right for you. I should let you know that we only do open memberships a couple times a year. We're doing one in June only for a week, and then one again in September only for a week. And the reason we do that is because we want to spend most of our time on you, the people in the tribe. Make sure that we're giving you all the love and all the support and everything that comes up to help you be that rock star innovator and have a stronger, more valued voice. So if you haven't checked it out, go do it. Now, today, as I said, is all about your innovator spirit, discovering the mindset to pursue the impossible. In fact, that's the name of Chuck Swoboda's book, The Innovator Spirit, Discover the Mindset to Pursue the Impossible. We dig into it. So let me tell you a little bit about Chuck. He is an innovator in residence at Marquette University, president at Cape Point Advisors, and retired chairman and CEO of Cree Inc. He is a co-inventor on more than 25 patents covering LEDs and lighting technology, and has over 30 years of experience in the technology business. And as I said, he's the author of this book that we're going to dig into. So Chuck knows what it takes to be an innovator. He knows what it takes to enable innovation in others. We have a really interesting conversation about why there is no box in his mind. We talk a little bit about kind of what are those things that we struggle with that keep us from innovating and what are the things that limit our innovative behaviors. And then, of course, you know, I dug in how to get over it. All right. Enjoy. And I hope to see you on the tribe. That's the place that we really get to connect.
Chuck, thank you so much for joining me today. I feel like we have a very robust conversation ahead of us.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, let's get to know you first. What's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
Boy, it's hard to imagine where I should start. Probably the most interesting is that, you know, I spent 25 years working at Cree as we grew the company from a startup into this global technology company. And, you know, it was all about taking risk and pursuing innovation. But for me, it almost never happened because the first time Cree offered me a job, I actually said no, because I thought it was too risky. And I had yet really to learn this idea that I would later come to discover, which is to be unafraid of failure. So for me, the guy who has spent 25 years in innovation, it almost didn't happen. And maybe on a more fun note, along those lines, at Cree, when I first interviewed, they made me play basketball at lunch as part of the interview process.
You're like, well, can you play?
Well, I'm tall. I'm 6'6". So like, yeah, I was okay. But these guys were playing like they were playing for the NCAA Final Four. But what I learned is that later on, we kept doing it. And what it ended up being is one of the most interesting and helpful ways to interview people, because it doesn't matter if they're any good at basketball. If you put someone in that moment, right, you see how they react under stress in a team context, you know way more about them than you'll ever get sitting in a conference room interviewing them.
So that's interesting. So do you think in that initial game of basketball that people bring, oh, for lack of sounding totally cheesy, but their most authentic self? Do they know what's happening? Do you still bring your best self? Or is it just because you're on the court playing, you just become very real?
I think you start out thinking you're going to bring your best self. And then in the moment, in the heat of competition, you know, you get tired, you're running up and down the court. At some point, you just start to react. And so I think what happens is you get past all the who we're trying to be, and you get at who someone really is.
Oh, that's so interesting. I've never had to play a sport. I thought you were just going to tell me that was part of their thing, like the ping pong table. So I did not expect that. I do want to ask you a question, though, about something you said when you were talking about being unafraid of failure, or you didn't realize you were yet. And I want to ask you about that, because I think right now, so we are recording this. I don't even know what the date is. Why? Because I've been home for 3 weeks.
It's April 7th.
Yeah. And I have no idea. So someone said to me, the only days that matter are yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Beyond that, who knows? But you know, we're in the throes of this COVID-19 pandemic and lockdowns across the country, and everybody's working from home. And I think fear of failure, fear of risk, there's a lot of fear out there. And I guess my question for you, when you said that, kind of what popped into my head was, can you really be unafraid, or is it really a matter of just understanding how to push through it? Because I'm not sure, like, primally we can really remove the fear, but there is a trick for getting over it.
So in my experience, you know, I started out in one place where it became for me is, if you go through an experience enough times and you survive it, you actually start to realize that this thing you're afraid of isn't real at all. And so fear is, you know, the fear of trying to do something is almost always worse, or thinking about doing something is almost always worse than actually doing it. So if you can get yourself to do it and go through it a few times, right, and you start to realize, hey, that wasn't that bad. And so what happened for me at Cree was every day something went wrong and you had to survive. And so eventually it became normal. It's like, you know, I didn't even think about it. It's like, yeah, that may or may not work. It doesn't really matter. Let's just try it, because worst case, we're going to learn something. And, you know, as I was putting the book together, and I have my podcast about innovation that I try to bring in people to talk about it, I ask everyone about their biggest failure. And what's interesting is most people can't relate to the concept that have had a lot of success in innovation. What they actually think of it as is, oh, I did a lot of things that didn't work. In fact, too many to ever tell you about. But I don't think of it that way. To me, it's just learning some new information I didn't have before, and I'll take that and learn something else from it. And so I really do think you can get to a different place.
What I'm hearing you say that I think is so important for all of us listening is, and I'm gonna botch this up the way I say it, but it's like practice makes you unafraid. You know, like you get comfortable with it because you know that it's not as bad as you think it's going to be. And to your point, being on the ledge is worse than jumping. It really is, you know, like if you bungee jumped, that's what I was trying to get to.
You know, when I was trying to figure out this whole innovation thing, you know, to me, and it's really a mindset, right? So many of us think about innovation as the steps in the process. To me, it is much more a mindset than anything else. And your mindset is a function of whatever beliefs you have that lead to your behaviors. The challenge most of us have is that our life experiences create beliefs that get in the way of innovation. So if, for example, we've learned, generally speaking, that you're taught it's better to avoid risk instead of taking risk. You learn that, hey, we should strive for best practice, when best practice means it can't be as good as something else. So we should be going for something better. Or even, you know, in this current moment, most of us are taught that a crisis is a problem. Right. I spent 25 years learning that every time there's a crisis, it is a moment of change and an opportunity to do something you probably couldn't do before. So in my mind, it is, if you create situations where you go through these new experiences and you start to learn something different, you really do reset some of those beliefs and you end up in a different place. That's why you know, at Cree, we learned it, but over, as we got bigger, we actually tried to screen for it when we were hiring new employees.
So I'm 100% with you on the mindset, by the way. I mean, our work is all in relation to how do you unlock the innovator inside of you versus how do you follow the process, the culture, the tools, the steps of innovation. And I'm sure you've seen this in your work time and time again. Clients will call us and say, well, we implemented this process, whatever the shiny ball is of the year that makes innovation happen, and nobody's doing it. And I'm always like, right, because you didn't invest in your people first.
So the whole reason I wrote the book is I was giving a talk at Marquette University. And at the end of my talk, they said, you know, we teach this course on innovation leadership. You're kind of saying some stuff that seems a little bit different. Would you take a look at it? So I went off, spent a couple months, read all the stuff, and I came back and said, you know, this is really interesting theoretical stuff, but none of it will work.
Right.
You are basically trying to teach them that this is something you manage. And the reality is management is fundamentally opposed to what I think it takes to do innovation. Because management is about getting people to follow some known rules or process, and you're really rewarded for delivering predictable outcomes. That's the point of management. In fact, the better you are at it, the worse you are at innovation, because innovation is kind of the opposite of that. And they're like, wow, that's really interesting. Could you write a book? And so I never intended to write a book, but that's how I got into it, because to me, it was kind of logical. And that was the first moment where I said, oh, the stuff we did at Cree isn't what everyone else is doing. There must be something different. And I knew it couldn't be the process, because the process is available for everyone.
So you've mentioned your book a few times. Let's dig into that. The title is The Innovator Spirit, Discover the Mindset to Pursue the Impossible. And it's all about embracing that innovator spirit, the mindset, like you were just talking about. I'd like to layer onto that where we are today with the ground, you know, shifting for all of us. How do you see the role of all of us being innovators in a time of crisis like we're in now?
Well, I think first you have to, you know, understand I start with a very basic premise that's probably different from a lot of people, but I believe and learned that every crisis is also a great opportunity for innovation, because it changes the risk reward balance in people's minds. You know, most people, and we talked about this earlier, are trying to kind of find this balance between risk and reward.
Yeah.
But in my experience, innovation don't work that way. It fundamentally requires risk, you know, because you're taking on a problem that there may not be an answer to. So what happens is, in a crisis, essentially the status quo stops working. So people don't really have a choice, right? They have to, they can either just say, oh, we're screwed, or, hey, I'm going to have to try and do something different. I think the other thing it does, so much of our energy, and most people spend their time on, is focused on this set of what I'll call competing priorities. There's all these things they need to get done. And in the reality, if you really were honest, there's usually one or two things that really matter and the rest kind of don't.
Yeah.
And in a crisis, typically people take that list, they throw it out and they go, what's the one or two things we got to get done? So you get this incredible ability to focus. So you get a better risk reward balance, you got this focus. And then in that moment, that environment, you have this opportunity to lead, because people are biased to change. They're looking for new solutions. And I think so for each of us, the people that are listening, this is their moment, right? All those ideas you had or things you wanted to try that you didn't think someone would consider in normal times, well, this is that moment, right? And it's not a moment to think about it. It's a moment to do something. You know, one of the people always ask me, what's kind of the first step? I said, well, you know, the future doesn't happen. You have to actually go make it happen. So like the first step of leadership is to actually lead. And so this is that moment. Take your best idea, put it out there, see what works, see what doesn't, adjust, and keep going. And the point is, in this moment, people will listen way more because they're looking for anything.
Don't you find too that they're also more accepting? And what I mean by that is, you know, whoever your customer is, whether you're in a B2B business or, you know, you sell products, whatever it is, if you shift and try new products, new ideas, new business models, new thinking, I think your customers also, in times like right now, because they're in it with you, are even more, because I think actually they are on regular times too, but even more willing to go along for the journey with you. So you don't have to, you can be less afraid of the mistakes, not it being not 100% right, because they get it, right? They get that you're trying to shift and change along with what's happening.
I don't think any, I think you have it absolutely right. I mean, I think this is that moment that not only do you as a leader change and the people around you, but absolutely the customers goes, hey, nothing's working the normal way, right?
Yeah, we get
We get it. So if you have an idea, let's try it. And you know, that's what I'm seeing in a bunch of situations is that you're seeing industries where people are embracing ideas that they would have never thought possible before.
You know, I think also what you're saying just reminds me of a conversation I just had. I think, you know, talking about the risk reward balance and changing a little bit. I think in a lot of ways too, and I'd love to hear your perspective on this, it actually flips what ends up being risky and what isn't. And the example I have is I was talking to a colleague of mine who's in the education department here in Colorado, and they have been talking about and exploring and investigating and setting up committees for years to move things to a more virtual online platform, not to get rid of schools, but just to have more of that available. And there was too much risk. The system was too big, the shift too great, you know, the list goes on. Now, what they've been trying to do for 3 years, they have to do in a week and figure it out. And so the risk for them becomes not having to shift the bureaucracy and all the money and time that takes. The risk becomes not doing it and not having school.
Yeah, you just picked one of my favorite examples. So I was on the board at Marquette for 12 years. And I remember for at least, I don't know, most of that time we were talking about online and virtual classrooms and how do we get there. And, you know, as an outsider, you're like, guys, you could just do this. Let's go ahead.
Right. And
look, every university made some incremental progress. But the fact is, as of three weeks ago, most major universities in this country, the majority of their classes were in-person instruction. Mm-hmm. And if we would have asked them 3 weeks ago, how fast, if we had to go as fast as possible, they would have said, we might be able to take the whole curriculum online in 3 to 5 years if we were really crazy about it.
Right.
And most would have said, that's not possible. And literally in 7 days, just about every higher ed institution went online. And you're going, wait a minute. It changes everything. And it's probably, you know, it's a unbelievably good example of, and by the way, it's not perfect. I happen to have a son who is a senior graduating this May. And he, you know, he's like, wow, it's not exactly like it used to be. It works generally, figuring it out, but he also knows the world's different. So he's embracing it. He's more open to it. And the professor's more willing to try things, and yet they're making it work. And I think not only that, so I think the thing for people to understand is they're not just gonna try it, but these moments, now we have people who have tried things and not everyone's going back to the way it was. Like these are technology moments that everyone has to try it and you end up in a different place on the other side. It won't be 100% online, but we certainly will never go back to where we were because in so many cases, we're finding out where the technology has an advantage.
So I want to dig into kind of an angle you're taking and you actually mentioned it before, which is about this idea that like really a crisis is actually an opportunity. And I totally agree with you. And you wrote this article, I think it was for Forbes where I read it, that says for industry leaders, social distancing is an opportunity to seize, not a problem to solve. So let's talk about this a little bit for a second, because I think it's a really important conversation to have is around how do we take what feels like uncertain, uneasy, a little bit of chaotic times and actually transform that mindset into one of like, hey, there is a lot of opportunity here.
Well, I think two things. So I think you've described the situation. It is factually like that, right? It is chaotic. It is uncertain. But that moment just means all the rules are up for grabs. So like most of my career was taking a small company, competing with big companies. It took us 25 years to become big. You know, the toughest problem you have is it feels like the system is rigged against you most of the time. Everyone's comfortable with what they're doing. No one's in a hurry to change. All that, the moment that all gets thrown out the window, it's open season, right? Now you can try these things. And so, you know, an example would be is, we talked about higher ed, but anything using this virtual technology is different now. If you look at telemedicine, right? Telemedicine has been around for 30 years. And I've had 2 doctor's appointments in the last 2 weeks online. And guess what? It was easier, more efficient. And you start going, why weren't we doing this? And then you start to ask yourself, well, wait a minute. I could drive to the doctor, but all the people that couldn't, that don't have access, wow, this idea really could work. And we talk about healthcare being expensive. It's got to be a savings there. Or another example that's personal to me, right? ideally, this is my first book, but I had all these events planned, right? I'm going to go speak here and speak there and speak there to talk about the book. Well, they're all canceled.
Like, yeah, they are.
Gone.
So are mine.
And you're going, right? And you're going, wow, the event business is dead, except that I've now started to get virtual event requests and I've already have two of them. And what you realize is that it, will it be the same? No, but these events can actually reach much larger audiences much easier than before. The fact is, everyone getting on an airplane, flying somewhere to go to an event, that's actually a highly friction-filled customer experience. Online is pretty close to frictionless. Amazon's kind of proven why that's helpful to people. So if you imagine, if you're a great speaker, you can actually access people much more widely because instead of 500 people going to an event, it's pretty easy to get 5,000 online. And so I think what we're going to see is the event business will look different. There will still be people talking and sharing their ideas, but it's not always going to be in person. And I'm not suggesting we get rid of in-person interaction. I absolutely think that is fundamental to the human condition. But I think we will find moments where we used to do some things pretty darn inefficiently that we can do better this way. And so I think, you know, how do you do that? It's kind of like restaurants that are in the takeout business that weren't before, or, you know, a local breweries are now doing delivery. Who ever heard of a brewery doing delivery? But there are things they will learn in this moment because we're not allowed to be together that I'm not sure all those business models go away. So I think it's just really a clever moment to go, okay, I can't do this, but what does it mean I can do? And what will people try that they wouldn't before? And then the last idea along those lines is someone, the other day I was talking with, they said, yeah, the only person that benefits from this is Amazon and Walmart because everyone buys everything online. And what's interesting is it's actually a bad deal for Amazon and Walmart. And the reason I say that is that when you're the market leader and the market grows at a certain rate, Amazon and Walmart can keep delivering the same customer experience day after day, and it's almost impossible to compete with their scale. This demand has blown up their model. So you go to Amazon now and it says you can't get something for 2 weeks. I don't know about you, but I don't hit buy. I go, I'm going to find it somewhere else. I have found 4 or 5 vendors that I've used in the last 2 weeks that I've never used before.
That's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. I've always been thinking about Amazon, about like, lucky, look at you guys. But you're right. You're right, because they can't deliver on what it is we love about them to begin with.
Right. Their value proposition is instant gratification, right? It's convenient and instant. Well, all of a sudden, if that goes away, I'm more open to consider other alternatives. So I now have 4 or 5 online accounts I didn't have before. And I've actually gone and bought some things, local pickup, that I wouldn't have bought before because it was in stock and it wasn't online. I'm going, wow, I am adjusting my behavior patterns because of this moment. And it's actually, I'm buying less from Amazon, not more.
You know, it's interesting. One of the questions that my team and I have been asking ourselves as we go through this, because like you, we do a lot of live, a lot of live events, a lot, team meetings, workshops, right? And it's interesting. I'll just pull back the curtain for a second. We have been developing and delivering digital programs and e-sessions and e-workshops and all that for years now, but it has never been the forefront of our business, even though I've always wanted to move the business in that direction. And now with this big shift, it really did free up the space for me to shift the balance in our business the way I've wanted to for a long time, but didn't, because I didn't have the bandwidth before, because all this other stuff was working so well that I had a hard time kind of making that shift I wanted to make. So the question that we've been trying to ask ourselves is, because I can't do this, what can I do instead? And I think that kind of, to your point about mindset, just frames up the whole thing as like, what you can't do is actually a blessing. It's actually good if you can kind of figure out the other side of it.
Well, if you think about this whole innovation problem that we're all so interested in, you know, I remember when Clay Christensen's book came out. So I was at early on in my career, and I remember this book coming out, and I'm reading it, and I'm going, wow, the innovator's dilemma, it's a people problem. Like, people can see it, but they can't change. Why not? Because their current world is going too good. They don't want to screw it up. So they're going to keep doing it. It's why Kodak couldn't get out of its own way, even though they invented digital photography, right? And you go, wow, in this moment, we just took away your safety net. You have no choice but to reevaluate now. And so I think you know, that's kind of this for these businesses that are like, yeah, I can't compete with Amazon. I'm going to keep doing it my old way. They don't have any choice right now. And so there will be more effective online businesses or virtual businesses as a result of this crisis than there were before, because they had no, because that's what they had to survive. Now, by the way, there's also a lot of companies that will suffer greatly, and I don't want to minimize that. And I recognize this is a tough time for a lot of people, but some number of those are going to end up in a better place when we're all done.
You know, there's a, so there's this restaurant down the street from me. It's like a trendy breakfast place with like the best pumpkin pancakes, that kind of place. And obviously they're shut down. The thing that I was impressed by what they've been doing is not just delivering food and just saying, okay, guys, we can take it to go. But they've been creating, because I too have children at home, they've been creating meal kits for you to buy. So you got basically get the ingredients, pick it up, right? Then you've got breakfast for the week or lunches for the week. And I thought that was just such a brilliant example of innovation, because it wasn't just let me discount what I already have, or let me just do what I already do, but you know, do it just, let me just deliver it to you versus sit down. It was really thinking through, how do I serve my customer and the new demands and the new needs that come up? Because I think the other thing that I read kind of in your work that I really appreciated was the idea that like this chaos also leads to new challenges that somebody needs to solve.
Oh, absolutely. You know, this idea, and I have a number of colleagues at Marquette, they're teaching online virtually now, right? They also have their kids at home and they're homeschooling them.
Yeah.
So they now just double, their life just got way more complicated, and you go, wow, there are services that they would value now differently than would exist before. Just like your point, meals to go. Oh, absolutely. People are like, give me some alternative to this. And so I think you've got the idea that there's not one answer out there, but there are clearly new problems that need to be solved. And that's where the opportunities are.
So I want to talk about what it means to have an innovator spirit. Will you give us just like, you know, I don't want to say high level, but what you would consider the umbrella view of this is really what it means.
So to me, and I use the word spirit on purpose because, you know, I think a lot of people put it in a, you know, a very religious context. But to me, if you get to what spirit really is, it's who somebody really is. Like I was talking about on the basketball court, mm-hmm. It's not who they say they are, or who they wish they are. It's who they really are. And the reason that's important is that what we're talking about is we're trying to get a set of behaviors that drive innovation that are somewhat unnatural to the way most of us have been trained or grown up or experienced or were taught to manage things, right? So, but to get different behaviors, you have to start with different beliefs. And that's why so many of us struggle, right? We work on behavior change when actually you can't actually change behavior unless you do belief change first. And so the innovator spirit is getting at what are these beliefs that enable the behaviors that make innovation possible. And what I try to explain is, and we've talked about some of them already, it's this idea of being more open to risk. It's being unafraid of failure. You know, one of the ideas is that I saw in my career and I've seen in lots of other companies I studied is this comfort with what I call the brutal truth. So this ability to live in an environment where we're just going to say exactly what we think is wrong in this moment. And we're going to assume everyone's going to start with the premise that they're listening to this as constructive feedback and they're not going to take it personally. And everyone says, well, that's really hard to do. But as I study these other companies, there's this idea that you can either try to make everyone feel good or you can ask everyone to start in a different place, which is assume that everyone's responsible for their own mental state. I spent 25 years in an environment where people said exactly what was on their mind, and I never assumed, other than the very first time, that it was personal. And after that first moment, which was, I went to my first management meeting and I'm sitting there and my boss starts it out at Cree and he hands out a piece of paper, hands one to everyone in the room. He goes, before we get started, I'd like you to read this. I flip it over and it is a copy of an email that I had written to a customer earlier that week. And he has circled the first sentence where I've made a grammatical error. And I'm like, oh my God. So I'm going, this is not a great way to start. So I'm some combination of embarrassed, frustrated, probably a bit mad in the moment. But as he talked, his point was really simple. Look, we can't afford as a young company to make these kind of mistakes. Everyone's got to take the time to get this kind of stuff right because the details matter. So if you're not going to do that, how are we going to be successful? It wasn't about me, I'm a bad person. But it was, reality was, I did screw up. It was up to me to fix it. And once you get that idea in your head and you get a group of people that think that way, you get this really different environment. So that's just another one of these examples of ways to, you know, frankly, you have to believe that it's about the idea, not the person, to pull that off. Because most people work in large organizations are pretty sure it's about the person first. And so that's where I'm trying to get at, is this mindset is really about these beliefs that we've really got to help ourselves kind of reframe them probably from where we start.
So let me ask you a question on that, because it's funny. I had that exact same experience with an email that I sent that was kind of sloppy, in all truth. And the president of the company got on me about it. And I was so embarrassed at the time, but he was absolutely right. I'm a big fan of debate ideas, not people, and constructive conflict. And I do think what you said is 100% true, that it sounds good, but people have a hard time with it. What is your advice for a team, or when you work with a team, how do you get them over that hurdle and transition to a place where it's a little too personal, they're debating people, not ideas, maybe people are holding back, or they're doing my favorite thing, which is like clarifying everything they say, not to disagree, but just to clarify, right? Just to like hide what they really think. How do you get them from there to the better place?
So it's kind of a self-correcting environment. And I want to be clear. I know that if most people tried this in their current organizations, they might get a bit of chaos. So I'm not suggesting this is simple, but I can describe what it looks like when it's working well. And what I told people is that there's a few ideas you have to start with. Everyone starts the conversation and has to be on the same page that it's not personal.
Yeah.
You've got to, essentially, it's a ground rule and everyone's got to buy in, and it's not optional. It's not like, hey, it's a ground rule for me, but not for you. And by the way, it's also not personal to the leader of the team. You got to be able to take it as well as dishing it out. So that's kind of step one. The second one is, I found the easiest way to get people to embrace this as the leader is you've got to initially make it about you. And you got to model the behavior. In other words, I often would try to show people, hey, here's what this problem looks like. So whether it was in a group meeting or even in a one-on-one, I would say, let me tell you about a situation that I got in a jam on. And what I would do is make a real example of where I struggled with basically the same concept. And most people go, yeah, I totally get that. When you then have the conversation that that's someone I'm talking about with you, that transition is way easier because they've heard the idea before they've become defensive. So I'm trying to slow down their defense mechanism. And then you basically have to realize that there's this accountability and everyone's got to hold everyone accountable. So in other words, in that group session, if someone starts rambling on, you say, hey, stop. That's not helpful. Can we just focus on the problem? And people go, well, that might embarrass them. Yeah, it might. But guess what? If you're going to pursue innovation, like, this is really hard stuff. Innovation is doing something no one's done before. So if you're not going to put all your energy on the real problem, it's why most people never actually get to any innovation, because if you have your energy on anything else, like, your odds go way down. So you have to create this moment. And then the next piece is, let's say we're having a conversation, something goes wrong. So in our environment, oftentimes, you know, we're inventing new technology with physics that didn't exist before. We tried a lot of stuff. And the reality is everyone heard about the stuff that worked, but most of it didn't. Like, I'd say you're probably running at about 80% failure to 20% success rate was what it was like over those years. But when you failed, where you had to get, the point was, what did I learn? Let's move forward. We spent no time looking backwards. So you said something earlier today, you said, you know, there's really only yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And I agree, but we refuse to talk about yesterday other than, did it go wrong? And what I want to know about, what would you do different? What are you going to differently from this moment forward? So we've learned from it and it doesn't happen. That's all I care about. Zero energy on blame or anything else.
So here's my question to you about yesterday. I'm so glad you brought that up. And we talk a lot about this in my work around how to shift people who are legacy thinkers to get them out of yesterday to tomorrow. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, on how you get those people. Because if you're in a big company, the reality is you and your team could be super innovative, but that person you need the final approval from may not be, right? Like, there's always legacy thinkers, and they have some value in my opinion. I'm actually not a like ignore all of them kind of person, but how do you think about getting those people to see a little bit more forward versus backward?
It's really hard. So what I usually tell people is this. I think that if you're in a large organization, and I had a chance to meet with one that's really interesting. It's called, it's an insurance company based in Madison. I can't think of their name right now. And it's a 93-year-old company doing some incredibly innovative things. And I was teasing out, how can you be innovative in an insurance? And what they said was, is they're two separate things. We want really innovative people working on one set of problems where innovation really matters. And it's, if we don't innovate, we're going out of business. But there's parts of the company where we have this expertise. They're like, we're really good at it. And we really don't want to disrupt it. So in other words, we're not trying to put really innovative thinkers in the claims department. Because when a customer calls up, they want a pretty well thought out experience of how to help them out. But when it comes to what's the future of car insurance look like when everyone's driving an automated or a self-autonomous vehicle, that's where we want people to think different because that's going to get blown up. But what they really talked about were they almost ran their organization with parallel mindsets. They put them on different problems. And so what I would suggest is if you're in an organization, you're trying to be innovative, and one of the people in the decision chain isn't bought in, that innovation is critical to their success. If that's not basically number one on their list that I'm going to fail if I don't embrace this idea, you have very little chance to drive serious change. So you have two choices. That person has to get out of the way or they have to embrace that this their job depends on it. How do you convince them? What I tell most people is you have to try to show them that in the future, they're in trouble if they don't embrace this. But I will tell you, that's really hard to do. I tried that a lot. And what I would find is that most people have to come to it. So for me, if I was going to pursue innovation in a large organization, I mean, I might do some incremental things in a small group, but if we've got to do something big, the leadership better buy in or it's going to get stuck. And so we did some consulting with a company recently and we were training their first and second level people on innovation and the mindset. But they were getting very frustrated because we didn't train the middle managers weren't a part of this. So the CEO was bought in, the lower levels were bought in, but the middle wasn't. And it just hits the wall. And it's going to because it's great that the CEO is bought in, but it has to happen from both directions, I guess is my point. And so my suggestion is, one, make sure innovation is the right solution for the problem. Because if it isn't, you're wasting your time. And if it is, the people in charge better be bought in because otherwise your odds of success are very low.
Yeah, it's hard to make any changes when the people who have to sign off in some way or another don't agree with you. I want to back up for 1 second though and just add a different perspective for a second. Because when you were talking about that insurance company, it makes me nervous when I hear a company say, we think some people get to be innovative and some people don't. And the reason why is, first of all, our research and the science behind it, right, has shown that everybody has the possibility of being innovative. All of our brains are wired for it. Some of us have more practice, to your point, and unleash it more than others. But we all have the ability to innovate. And I think innovate in the roles that we have, like maybe that innovation is not some autonomous cars and something out there. Maybe that innovation is an improvement on customer service because you see a new way to solve a problem. And I'm just curious when you work with these companies, because I hear what we're saying, right? Like the things have to get done and we know they're good. But at the same time, I think making that type of distinction is very dangerous because you miss opportunities to innovate in the places where you think you're solid, where you think we just do the business. And I think on top of that, the bigger unintended consequence of saying, hey, these people get to innovate and you don't, is the people that don't actually, what we've seen is their motivation and their engagement drops because we're humans. We all want to contribute. We all want to create a problem solve. And we're being told we're not allowed to do that.
Yeah. So I let me clarify one really important point. I think this will make sense. I have a very specific definition of innovation. Something new solves a problem and creates real value. And so I have a very high standard on what that means. And so to me, incremental improvement is not an innovation. It is important, it's necessary, but I would actually approach incremental improvement quite differently than I would approach innovation. So for example, if I was trying to make incremental improvement, there's a lot of tools and techniques that I think could be very valuable to that. You know, the idea of whether it be Lean or Six Sigma or any of these approaches where you're taking a distribution and you're getting rid of, you're optimizing right. within
you're minimizing the waste.
Those are great approaches. That's not innovation. When I say innovation, if it's in the distribution already, it's not innovation in my mind. And then that doesn't mean I'm right or wrong. I'm trying to be very specific about one, what some people would call one type of innovation. And so when I gave you that example, we were using my definition around that. So their point was they absolutely want the claims department to make incremental improvements and make their job better each day. They're not excluding them, but they don't want them coming in one day going, hey, let's just try a radically different customer service process that's not based on our past experience, because they don't want the customer to go through that on a day-to-day basis. So they're trying to find this balance. And they actually then take, when they have an idea, they actually have what they call, I think they're called innovation associates or something. They literally embed people in both sides of the organization for periods of time to make these ideas joint ideas. They literally develop them together. So I think they're much more aligned with what you're suggesting, but I'm using innovation to be really what you'd probably call the bigger ideas.
Got it. So you're really talking about those, lack of a better way to say it, the blue sky stuff. Because I think the challenge sometimes that we face, right, is that there are so many of us who don't get to play with autonomous cars. And that's why I love the title of your book, Innovator Spirit, because it tells me, oh, I can have a little bit of that in my role, in my job, in my life too, even though maybe I'm not, you know, riding bicycles across a Google campus and playing with virtual reality all day.
Yeah. And to be clear, I don't believe innovation is a technology thing. I think technology is one of the ways we get there. But to me, it is technology agnostic. There's social innovation. There's all these things count. The reason though, I try to make that distinction is a lot of what I'm talking about in the book is not the new idea.
Right.
It's how to convince people to either embrace the idea or make them understand they want the idea. So for example, in an incremental improvement, it's usually not a very big problem to convince someone they would like something that's a little cheaper or a little faster or a little easier to use, right? When you invent an LED light bulb, we went to our customers and said, hey, we've got this incredible device. It uses 1/10 the energy and lasts 10 times longer. Wouldn't you love one? And they said, nope. We don't really care about our light bulbs. What do you mean you don't care about them? We don't care. Like, it's an irrelevant thing in their life. So the problem, the innovation problem I'm describing in that part of the book is, wow, okay. How do you create a reason for people to care about something? And you get into this idea that innovation is often about understanding what is a problem that they want solved, not what is the feature. So often we get focused on features in businesses. Hey, I can do this for you. It's irrelevant. What people pay for are benefits to their life somehow. And the aha for us is, and it was a pretty low tech one. The moment we started explaining that what LED lighting was a way to save you money, people were very interested. But when it was saving you energy, pretty much like 1 out of 10 people cared. And that was up to us, because it happened to save you money, but that's not where we started, because that wasn't the feature we started with. And so I the reason I say that is so much of it is about this pushing your mindset to take on this, you know, how do you convince people to embrace a technology they don't think they want or an idea they don't think they need? And there you get into some levels of things that I think go further. And that's why for me, the way I did that is that's how I distinguish between inventions or improvements and innovations.
And
it doesn't
innovation.
Make it right. I'm trying to say there's this, in fact, you'll probably appreciate this. Oftentimes in my mind, the greatest innovators didn't actually invent the idea.
Yeah,
they just
usually,
made it
right?
relevant. They made it relevant. So, you know, the Macintosh is this phenomenal, you know, the Macintosh computer comes out and it's a incredible graphical user interface and a mouse. Steve Jobs admits he didn't invent any of it. All he did was package it up and convince people that it would work in a way that they made him want. It was all invented elsewhere. And so that's the subtlety I'm trying to get at. And it's not a right or wrong, but they're different things. And so what I'm trying to help people understand, if you want to push for something that's truly not been done before, you've got to go further than just this inventing thing.
I want to ask you a question. I'm going to jumble a little bit because it's in my head and I'm going to say it as I'm thinking about it, say it at the same time. But, you know, I want to focus on the word kind of impossible and future for a minute, because what you were saying about finding that need reminded me of this. You know, like you, I've been in innovation for years. And so I used to be on the other side of the glass mirror where you watch these horrible focus groups. I can't stand them. That's a whole nother soapbox for us to go on. But, you know, it would be people kind of really sharing their challenges that we then were trying to figure out how to solve. The reality is they were telling us yesterday's challenges, because we don't know what the future looks like. And as consumers, people, right, we're not skilled at saying, here's where I will be in 5 years. And like, I'm pretty sure if you had put the iPad into a focus group, people would have been like, wait, you want me to use this device? It doesn't have all computing power of my computer, but it is, and it's big, and oh, I can't make phone calls from it. Like, what? What's the point of this thing? In the meantime, right, that's changed everything, and we all have one. So what is your advice for people trying to be that innovator and find innovation the way you're talking about it, when some of that requires not just getting bogged down in today's conversations, but really looking to the future to solve tomorrow's problems and understand where tomorrow's opportunities are?
I think the trick is that you have to show them a different future, but based on a problem they think they have today. And I think the subtlety is it's not a future problem. It's a today problem. And so, you know,
they just don't know they have it yet.
Right. Or they don't see the connection between the two. So, you know, if you think about it, right. So, I mean, I lived this experience. So we invent LED lighting, and for 2 years, nobody. So first we invent just the LED itself, the semiconductor that makes this great light. I spent 2 years trying to sell them to every lighting company in the world. And I got zero customers to buy zero. And I met with them over and over. And in the end, what they said is, that's really cool. It's amazing technology. We don't need it. Why not? My customer's not asking for it. Hmm. Well, they're not going to ask for it if you don't show it to them. I'm not going to work on something they're not asking for. That doesn't make any sense. So what do you do in that moment? So what we said is, it, you know, feels like we need a darn revolution to convince them. And in fact, I presented at a conference very early on in front of all the major large light bulb companies. I said, someday we're going to use LEDs for everything in our homes and everything in our offices. The three CEOs got up after me and said, that's a nice young guy. It's cool technology. There's no way it will ever be used for all these things, because what we have today, we already know for sure consumers think is good enough. They right. don't want anything better. So, okay, so what do you do? So what we did is we said, you have to start a revolution. And literally, we started out with a marketing campaign, and we called it the LED lighting revolution. If you go back and read now, you'll read about this revolution. It was just a marketing idea in the early days, because we had no other choice. Like, we had no customers, so you might as well call it something. And you go down this path, and what you realize is you have to create a vision for the future. And then you have to sell it and share it with people and tell them why it will make their lives better. And that was a slow and difficult process. And then what we found is the key was to convince somebody to try it. Because once you start to create real examples, you start to build momentum. And then as we went along, we had success. And the story most people don't ever realize is, you know, Cree makes commercial LED lighting a real product in a real market first. We come out with the LED bulb later. And the reason we did it was not to sell LED light bulbs. So we didn't know how to convince the mass public that they wanted LED lighting. We could convince a company because we could make a payback analysis, right? Hey, if you buy this, it'll save you money. Right. You don't have to replace it. They got it. But how do you convince a consumer that doesn't care? And what we realized is you got to show it to them. So we invented the Cree LED light bulb after trying for many years to get other companies to do it, because we figured out that the easiest way to get someone to buy into this technology was to see it and to try it. So we came out with a bulb at a price that looks just like their old bulb and convinced the Home Depot to put it on their shelves. That experience of seeing it and trying it, that changed the market. Once people started seeing it and trying it, we then followed up with an advertising program and an awareness campaign that was not about the Cree bulb, but about, are you really still buying that antiquated old technology and throwing money down the drain? We spent 2 years convincing people that they were wasting their money. And in the end, we created an industry. Now, it helped us and our competitors, but that's what it took. And that's what I'm trying to get at with some of these things, is you've got to get into people's minds and show them a different future and convince them they want it.
Well, you just summed it up exactly what I was going to say. I think the power in that story is you need to show it to them, what the future could look like for them, and give them opportunities to actually experience it. I think oftentimes when you're trying to move the needle and do something wildly innovative or changes the game in the marketplace in some way, people need to experience it a little bit first, right? It's a big leap. You're asking people to jump, which is great. Some people do, but most of us need a little bit of time to kind of test it out and give it a run for its money and see how it goes before we can really buy into it.
Absolutely. You know, everyone likes to quote Steve Jobs as saying he didn't believe in market research. And if you really read what he said, he didn't believe in you would go ask them if they wanted a tablet if they've never seen one. And, you know, right. His point would be is a customer can't tell you they want something they don't know is possible. That's right. Pretty logical. But he would say is once you can build one and make it do something, there's nothing wrong with letting them try it and play with it and see what they think. And you may or may not work, but the point is now you can get a real experience and feedback but by the way, that's a really messy process. That's where, you know, at the time they were doing that, design sprint wasn't as common of an idea, but today it's become this great, it's just a way to test ideas, right? Like let's get it out there and test these things because people are pretty good at reacting to something they can touch, feel, and interact with.
One of my favorite parts of my job when I was doing more new product development work was we would rent kiosks in the mall and we'd create mock-ups of everything. And we would just see if we could get people to come over and what they'd play with and what they'd look at and if they'd even come over. And it was, to your point, right? We were showing them a future and then we needed to see, do they like the future that we're showing them? And where are the gaps? And it was I didn't love standing in a mall for 12 hours at a time, but it was so much fun to see, you know, I mean, you've probably been to this yourself, right? You stand in Home Depot and you watch people look at your products and it's fascinating, isn't it?
Oh, and what's interesting is the biggest challenge I think for me as really an engineer by training is I was so excited about what our product did. I had to learn how to objectively observe what was happening because we are all looking for confirmation bias, right? We are all out there to try to prove ourselves right. And I met someone one time this is his quote, but I'll just repeat it because I think it's so helpful. So many people spend all their time trying to be right. They actually miss the opportunities for success. I think it's an incredibly wise way to think about this is you actually want to test, you want to assume that they will hate it. Because if you do, you're much more likely to see what they really think about it. Because if you assume they're going to love it, it's so easy to confirm things that aren't true.
That bias is really dangerous. And I think that advice that you just gave is a really great way to close out the podcast because I couldn't agree more. This isn't just about getting out there and testing. It's about really being objective. And I think, you know, part of the innovator spirit, right, is being open to your point about the blunt truth. Being open to what people gravitate to, don't gravitate to, what they like, what they don't like. I think if you always have that mindset of like, okay, how does what somebody else is saying improve my thinking, my product, whatever, you can get there. So with all that, where can people go to learn more, get the book, connect with you?
So the best way to get more information is go to my website, chuckswoboda.com. You can also follow me on LinkedIn or on Twitter or Instagram at @thechuckswoboda. I have a podcast called Innovators on Tap that's pretty much available anywhere. And my book is now available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever you buy your books.
All right, Chuck, this has been fabulous. What's your final piece of advice for all of us innovators on Launch Street?
It's two-part. Because you made me think of something with your last question. I woke up every day assuming that whatever I did today, I could do better tomorrow. If you start there, it's really easy to not get stuck on your old idea. And then the second thing I would say is that innovation is this amazing tool. I like to call it the great equalizer because it gives the underdog not only a chance, but it often gives them an advantage. So I would encourage whoever's listening, embrace the opportunity and don't look back because that's not where the future lies.
Oh my gosh, I think I'm going to take that advice. So Chuck, thank you so much for joining us. That was absolutely fantastic. A lot of great insights in there.
Well, I really enjoyed talking to you and look forward to maybe talking again at some point.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.